Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, that's me, and Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hi, Richard.
Lionel, where are we?
Well, we are in the President's Suite of the Aviva Stadium in Dublin, looking out onto the pitch. Terrific stadium, home of the Irish rugby team and the Republic of Ireland football team. I've never been inside before, but it's, I can imagine it full. It would be absolutely rocking. Just explain, it's where the press centre has been for the third stage of the Giro d'Italia today.
Correct. So we've just watched the third stage of the Giro. That's the Giro in Ireland finished now. The riders will transfer to Italy to resume the race there. But it's been an eventful 3 days, a very successful 3 days in Ireland. And we've ended up here in Dublin. Now, Daniel, I believe you've been to Dublin before.
I think a grand total of about 40 minutes. I was supposed to be going to the Isle of Man for a work-related trip. I can't remember whether I was seeing Mark Cavendish or Johnny Bellis, but it was a particularly stormy day. We were in, I don't want to defame whichever airline it was, but it was I think there's probably only one Manx airline. And I wouldn't describe their aircrafts as planes, I would describe them more as darts. And it was extremely windy. There were two aborted landings. We had to go to Dublin twice. I didn't want to fly or didn't want to go anywhere in a plane for the next 6 months afterwards. It was one of the most traumatic days of my entire life. It was horrific.
So happy memories for Daniel here in Dublin. So we've got some little interviews to play in this podcast, which will wrap up our 3 days in Ireland. We'll hear from Marcel Kittel, who's won two stages. We'll hear a little bit from Bernie Eisel of Team Sky. And then later on in the show, we've got Matt White, the Director Sportif at Orica GreenEdge, Charlie Wigelius from Garmin Sharp, and Brent Copeland from Lamprey Meridia.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So we are reflecting first, I think, on the third stage, which was from Armagh to Dublin. Not an awful lot happened in the stage. There were a few crashes. Michele Scarponi was caught up in a crash. Cameron Meyer was caught in a... He went down very heavily on a roundabout and looked pretty dazed. And he did finish. I tried to get an interview with him at the finish, and he was fairly definitive in saying no way.
He still looked a bit dazed as he came into where the buses were parked, didn't he?
I'm sure that's the only reason he declined my request for an interview. But yeah, he looked in a pretty bad way. But it was a stage that was really all about Marcel Kittel. I mean, his first stage win in Belfast on Saturday was reasonably straightforward. It perhaps wasn't a perfect lead out from his team giant Shimano, but once he saw daylight, once there was daylight between him and the line, there was no question of him winning, and he won by well over a length from Nasser Bouhanni. Today was a different story altogether, and we can hear now from Marcel Kittel as he describes the finale to the third stage.
Yeah, what happened was that we tried to do our sprint preparation pretty early today. That's basically not a mistake, because I think at 2 kilometers before the finish, the road became quite narrow, and we wanted to be in front there, and that worked out. But unfortunately, just before that first left corner of those two that came behind each other at 1.3 kilometers, I lost the wheel of Tom Wheelers, because there were two riders coming, one from the left, one from the right, and I got sandwiched, and I had to let go or I crashed. And afterwards, it was one big line, and I was on, I don't know which position actually, maybe 12, 13, really far in the back for the speed. And I thought, okay, I cannot give up now. And I fortunately was in the wheel of Bouhanni, who thought probably the same and tried to close gaps and come back to the front. And yeah, when we came on the finish line, I saw the finish. I knew how far it was, and I just tried everything and tried to go still for the win. And yeah, it was close, but it was still possible.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
That was Marcel Kittel describing his victory on the third stage in Dublin. He could come from a long way back, maybe 10th, 12th wheel, but it was more than the places, it was a distance. As he said, the bunch was in a long line coming out of those two 90-degree left-hand bends. He mentioned that he was on the wheel of Nasser Bouhanni, who obviously hadn't given up hope either of still getting up there, and that perhaps gave him almost a perfect lead out to jump up to Ben Swift. He described it as more of an attack than a sprint. Swift looked like he had it. Team Sky did a very good job of leading him out. Edvald Boasenhagen was a good lead-out man, and it looked like Swift had it, but Kittel appeared and somehow managed to win the stage. It obviously took quite a lot out of him because he collapsed beyond the line. What did you make of it, Lionel?
Well, it was incredibly impressive, wasn't it? When he said in the press conference afterwards that it was more like an attack than a sprint, it kind of reminded me of some of Cavendish's sprints when he really was at the very peak of his game. He would just sort of rocket out of the bunch and finish a long way clear. Obviously, Kittel didn't finish a long way clear today, but as you say, from that final corner, he was out of it. And I mean, it's always interesting when you see a lot of the journalists who are watching on TV, the reaction when a rider crosses a line, and then really what it was a kind of like wow moment. You know, everyone was quite amazed that he'd made it so far back, and he did have it before the line. You know, the last 25 to 50 metres, he had it wrapped up. Ben Swift was beaten, and there's no doubt he is the best in the world at the moment, isn't he?
Well, Michael Matthews said that. Michael Matthews, the race leader, was pretty unequivocal in saying that he is the fastest man in the world at the moment. Yeah, he was like a train, wasn't he? The only Cavendish victory I can think of that was comparable, really, was maybe Brieve in 2012 when he was picking them off. And it was a little bit different because there was a breakaway just out front. Leon Sanchez was there. And Cavendish had to sort of jump from one man to the other, picking them off before the line. Otherwise, we've seen him win by a long way, but not coming from so far back like that. Daniel, what were your thoughts?
You two have got short memories, haven't you? Hey, Mark Cavendish hasn't won a race for a week, and he's suddenly well down the pecking order of the
defender in chief.
He's not well down the pecking order, but there can only be one best in the world.
Mark,
and if this was the sort of if this was heavyweight boxing at the moment, Marcel Kittel is the is the number one in the world in a bunch sprint.
You're right in that Kittel is on top of his game. And okay, today was a victory of brawn more than anything else, but he's in that psychological space where he's making a lot of the right decisions, and is clearly full of confidence. He did have a lean spell in the spring, a bit of a frustrating spell in March and April, but he seems to have come out of that now. His lead out train wasn't particularly good today, and it's just getting incredibly chaotic in those final kilometres in sprints these days. Amazing that there weren't any crashes. I mean, I think it was only sort of testament to how safe the course was, how wide the roads were, that we didn't have any crashes. But yeah, extremely impressive.
I think, well, I tweeted something a bit earlier, but in the forthcoming cycling anthology, Cavendish describes Marcel Kittel as Ivan Drago from the Rocky film. Not even Dolph Lundgren, the actor who plays Ivan Drago, but actually the character from the film. And obviously there's a very strong physical resemblance. You know, they've got the same haircut and the same face, basically. They are the same person.
You can exclusively reveal they are actually the same person.
They are the same person. Yeah, Marcel Kittel, when he was before he was born, was in a Rocky movie. Yes, but as Daniel said, there it was a victory for Braun, and that is how Marcel Kittel sprints, isn't it? He is pure power, and we've all commented a bit about how the giant Shimano lead out train hasn't really worked, and that, you know, it wasn't necessarily that they made a mistake, but Kittel lost Tom Wheeler's wheel today and basically had to back off as two riders came round him, so that's not necessarily a mistake, but the lead out train doesn't need to be working perfectly because Kittel's so strong.
I spoke to Rolf Aldag yesterday, who's now at Omega Pharma Quick Step, about the lead outs and about the difference between Cavendish's lead out and Kittel's, and also Cavendish's when he was at HTC Columbia. And he just said that Giant Shimano have had the advantage of being able to work on this over a long period of time, and they've not really had that much scrutiny. If you think of the individuals that were involved in Cavendish's best lead out train, the Hincapies and the Renshaws, and they were already big names in their own right. So people's kind of attention was naturally drawn to what the lead out was doing, how each element of it was performing. But, you know, with all due respect to the Giant Shimano guys, they don't have that reputation. And I consequently, I think that you know, perhaps we sometimes overestimate how good they are at times and we overlook some of their mistakes.
Yeah, let's hear now from Rolf Aldag. And following Rolf Aldag, we'll hear from Bernie Eisel, who was a member, of course, of Cavendish's lead-out train at HTC. And he was instrumental in helping Ben Swift get up there for the finish today. So first, Rolf Aldag of Omega Pharma Quick Step director, and then Bernie Eisel.
Last year, the lead-out train particularly came into for a lot of scrutiny, and people were saying that Kittel had kind of reinvented the lead-out and, you know, a lot more aggressive, a lot later and stuff. Have you made big adjustments this year with how you want to conduct the lead-out?
Well, we brought in Renshaw, obviously, and we have the guys riding more together than last year. So we kind of keep them more and more together. We have some flexibility, and we try and to play a little bit around. But the thing is, the big advantage is, like, on Kittel is the same that we had in 2007. Nobody really looked at them. They had the time and the freedom to develop their lead out because expectation have them in there. If you do have Cavendish, you always be watched to say it has to be perfect, and if not, like, you blame to fail, which is not always the truth, and this is like makes it a lot more difficult. Then, you know, you try, you practice, it works, it doesn't work, you lean back, you discuss about it, you do it again and again and again till you have it perfect. And I think that's what Giant has done really, really good, but they had the time to do it. Yeah. And for us, it's a lot more tricky. Like, everybody looks at Kev, so he leaves HTC, where I think you can't do better than that.
And if people said to you that the standard just wasn't as high then, and that everyone kind of just sat back and let you do your own thing because they were resigned to Cav being superior, would you say that's unfair?
Well, I think the point at that stage was that they kind of gave up. They tried multiple times and they kind of gave up.
Yeah.
And there was no way, we discussed it yesterday, it's like there was no way really to attack that train. Because, yeah, even if you would get around Tony, you would not have the forces to bring it to the line. Yeah, if you would try to get around George, you would die to the line, so there was just no possibility. And, like, from pure horsepower, I don't see Giant as that strong. They're really good bike riders, but it's not that you cannot beat them in just pure power, like in a drag race next to each other. And that was impossible in these days, that just no team had the power to do it. And but yeah, I mean, those are, you know, that's history. That's some years ago, and now I think everybody adjusts. And for sure, the competition gets, you know, bigger in terms of you have Lotto for Greipel, you have Giant for Kittel, and you have OPQS for Cavendish, and others will work on that as well. So indeed, it's from that point, it's going to be more difficult. But let's see how it turns out. It's exciting, isn't it?
That was quite a decent lead out from Team Sky there in the final. You did a sterling job bringing Ben Swift and Edvald up to the front.
Yeah, thanks for that. No, actually, it was just pretty much a normal day in the office for us. And yeah, I was up there the last 30 km because it was pretty tricky left and right. A lot of wind, and I thought just stay at the front. And Swift, he had a mechanical, had to swap his bike, so he even sprinted on his spare bike. And I waited at the front till he comes back. And yeah, the problem was we had a massive headwind, 3 km to go, but at the same time, it made it a bit easier to stay up there. And I think Swift is happy with the job.
Did you get a view of the sprint, or were you too far back?
Really far back. I just sat up and rode home easy. Next to me, I just see my teammates doing some cool down on their kickers. I did my cool down on the last 3 km.
And Ben, I mean, he went very close again today. He's gone close to the Giro before. Can he win one of these stages? I mean, Kittel's obviously very hard to beat. But perhaps some of the hillier stages a bit.
He definitely
later
can win
week.
A stage. He definitely has the form, and I think today he proved it himself again. And he's on the list of many people that he will win a stage here in this Giro. It's just a matter of time. And yeah, at the moment it looks like he can't beat Kittel on the flat. But never say no.
Is that the team's main focus at this Giro to help Ben Swift?
Yes. I mean, we have like a pretty good team leveled out. We have for the sprint, we have Eddie and Ben, so we always can play on two cards. CJ is there for the lead out like me, and yeah, two guys for GC, so we're not the major contenders.
But it's slightly different, isn't it, to the way that Team Sky's been set up for Grand Tours the last couple of years, when the focus has all been on winning the race outright.
Yes, it is. And we normally always go in with one leader, and just that's all about GC. And this race, everybody has his freedom, and let's see if we also get criticised for that.
And what about you? You're riding the Giro. You missed out on the Tour last year. I think you were disappointed to miss the Tour last year. Is the Tour on your programme for this year as well? Do you want to go back there?
Yeah, of course. I was disappointed last year. It would have been my 10th Tour, and it's the biggest bike race in the world. But yes, same as last year. I'm still on a long list, like how it's called. And we'll see. First of all, I want to finish this Giro. Finish as Interesse, and it's a really close to my hometown, and yeah, that's the first goal, and then recover a little bit, and then see probably they bring me to the Tour or not.
What do you, the Team Sky's had a very sort of troubled last couple of months with injuries and illnesses and so on. Is that just bad luck? What do you put that down to?
Of course it's some kind of bad luck, and if riders gets sick and have health problems, you can't change it anyway. Each team has to struggle with it. It just depends on which timing it comes. But at the same time, the classics were much better than last year, where we got a lot of criticism. So this year we were better, and it's still not good enough. So, and we're at the same time. Okay, everybody thinks we're the superheroes. We're Team Sky, but the same, just the same riders, and just do our job. And there's no robots out there. It's just human people.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we're reflecting also on not just on the third stage, but the whole big start in Ireland, which began in...
Clunky phrase, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Good, is it? It's not good. But it started in Belfast, really on Thursday evening with the opening ceremony, and carried on Friday with the team time trial. And it's been a really successful few days. Shame about the weather. That's been a real pity, because the weather can be good. In fact, the weather's beautiful now. This stadium is bathed in sunlight now. It's a bit late for that. But there's been a lot of rain. That's affected the racing, I think. There's been a lot of caution, a bit of, you know, there are always nerves the first few days of a Grand Tour, but I think particularly the stage finish in Belfast on Saturday was a sort of cautious, slightly muted affair, I felt. Daniel's looking sceptical at that, but I feel it has probably affected the racing a little bit. Bike riders are not as up for racing when the weather isn't very good. Even at the Giro, but it hasn't affected the crowds. The crowds have been phenomenal,
and the atmosphere has been phenomenal as well. And I think it was interesting listening to Darragh McQuaid of Shade Tree Sports, that instrumental in bringing the Giro here, talking about one of Belfast's main aims was to show the rest of Europe and the rest of the world that the city has changed. Obviously, it's got a long and fairly dark past with terrorism and sectarianism. And, you know, our taxi driver said to us a couple of days ago, you know, the city wasn't, you know, for once wasn't green and orange, it was pink. And, you know, the sort of pink symbolism and the branding of the Giro really is incredibly strong. I mean, more so, I think, than the Tour de France. I mean, when you go to the Tour, yeah, the yellow is there all the time, but for some reason, the pink just looks, it looks much more striking. And Belfast, you know, certainly they threw their arms wide open and embraced the Giro. And I think, you know, I know it's only a taxi driver saying it, but the local kind of feeling is that after this they will bid for the Tour de France at some point. And I can see no real reason why in a few years' time the Tour wouldn't come here.
Yeah, pink was, I mean, they embraced pink as much as they embraced the race, and the two things were sort of inseparable, I suppose. And it's fortunate, I guess, that pink doesn't have any of the symbolism of certain other colours. Well, in the
it would have been a deal breaker if it had, well, wouldn't, yeah, it really
would. Well, I did wonder, they've changed the King of the Mountains jersey from green to blue. Have they done that this year, or right, was that, no,
it's
okay,
a couple of years,
all right, okay. Well, yeah, I was just wondering, you know, if they'd still had the green King of the Mountains jersey, whether that would have been
green is even sort of across the divide. Green, I suppose, is the colour of Ireland, so the Northern Ireland football team wears green, so I'm not sure that would have been such a problem. As Inner Ring, the great blog Inner Ring, pointed out a couple of days ago, the Gazzetta dello Sport was originally printed on green paper in its very early years, so the Maglia Rosa might have been the Maglia Green.
Verde, Richard.
That pronunciation there was shocking.
Of green.
No.
But it was pink is pink. Is a sort of, I suppose, a joyous colour, and it was a sort of expression of enthusiasm and joy that the Giro was here, and it was very nice to see, and it was a quirk that really did catch people's imagination, I think.
In terms of the foreign grand departs you've been to, I mean, how does this kind of stack up? Because I'm thinking, you know, London was amazing because it was so big and the crowds were so huge. I think that took everyone by surprise. Rotterdam, when the tour went there in 2010, that didn't give me a particularly warm feeling. Amsterdam, when the Giro went there, was quite good. I remember the one in Liège. The Giro started there in 2006, or Serang, just outside Liège. I mean, that was, it may as well have been on the moon for all of the kind of the local people got behind that.
Flex. I think the moon is next. Yeah. What about Copenhagen? Were you in Copenhagen for the start of the Giro a couple of years ago?
No, missed that one.
Sure, that did look good. I think that was a success as well. But I think this has been a terrific success. Belfast, just the right size of city to host the Giro d'Italia. It's it was big enough that it took over the city, and they were a sort of perfect match for each other, I think. And it's been nothing but positive.
I think they'll certainly think that, you know, the goal they set out with, which was to show Northern Ireland, Belfast, and Dublin as well in a good light, as you know, they've succeeded. Everyone, you know, in Belfast was fully behind the event, and it's probably, cycling is probably the only sport that really could have kind of drawn people out of their houses and onto the streets in that kind of way. I mean, if you had, say, a football tournament, or, you know, cycling isn't as tribal, is it? It isn't as, there isn't sort of support for one particular team or one particular rider. It's something where people will come out to cheer and support the event.
We heard earlier on from Ricardo Taranto, the Giro chief executive, isn't he, of RCS Sport. Interestingly, he was talking about how important the foreign big start has become to the Giro as a branding exercise as well. We tweeted a rumour yesterday, I think, that the Giro could start in Dubai. It's rumoured, certainly on the race, there are quite strong rumours that the Giro will start in Dubai in 2016, and that there could even be an announcement during this year's race. And he was asked about future foreign starts, and he didn't rule out the possibility of taking it once again outside mainland Europe.
He sounded very taken with Japan, didn't he? He mentioned Japan about five times.
A couple of times. Warning bells. He mentioned South America as well, Colombia. So maybe Colombia in 2018.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, everything in cycling at the moment is kind of up for grabs, isn't it? The sort of the traditional way of doing things isn't necessarily going to hold if there are strong and compelling commercial reasons for things. And I think, although we, in its current format, could you go to Dubai and do 3 days and then have the third rest day as well in the same format as we've had with Belfast? Possibly not. They might even have to look at, altering the structure of the Giro d'Italia to accommodate. You might see something where they go somewhere further afield for longer, 4 or 5 days somewhere else. I mean, that was the theme of certainly his press conference after today, was that they will look at all possibilities. And I would have thought going to Dubai for 3 days isn't perhaps not as sustainable as going for 4 or 5.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Okay, let's look at how the Giro is poised as it returns to Italy, with Michael Matthews in the pink jersey, Marcel Kittel on a bit of a roll, winning stages. The sort of first 3 days, what did they tell us about the race? Well, they told us that Dan Martin won't sadly be challenging for the podium because he crashed out in the team time trial on the wet roads around Belfast on Friday evening. And we spoke the following morning to his director, Charlie Wigelius, who told us a little bit about what happened and how the team Garmin-Sharp would regroup and try and get something out of this Giro.
Morning, Charlie. We talked before the race about the importance of trying to get through the opening 3 days without a mishap. Obviously, you had terrible misfortune yesterday. Can you explain from your vantage point in the following car what happened and what caused the crash?
Well, to be honest, I saw very little because at the time that it happened, I was just looking at my notes and I was just about to warn the riders of a tricky corner coming up just after the second time check, which was a 90 degree bend to the right, and I looked up from my notes and the riders were on the floor. So, you know, it happens so quickly in that time you don't really see what's happening, so we just had to deal with it as best we could.
Have any of the riders explained what happened? Because on the TV footage it looks like they got over a manhole cover but the crash actually happened on a perfectly ordinary stretch of the road. Was the manhole cover a factor?
Yeah, it definitely was, because I think that's what started the problem. And I spoke to Dan and he said that he almost kept it up, so that kind of explains a slight delay from him hitting it to actually losing his balance. So obviously you have to look at those things and analyse it and try and see if there is something to take from it, but there comes a time also when you just have to say that that's how it went and it was bad luck, and not, you know, grovel in it too much.
So Daniel Martin has a fractured collarbone, so does Koldo Fernandez. Does that mean you start today with seven?
Yeah, we start with seven riders.
And in terms of Dan, I gather he's going to have an operation just to make sure everything's okay with his collarbone. Is it too early to talk about the Tour de France for him?
Yeah, I think it is. I think we need to let the doctors do their job, get him operated and get, you know, an assessment of the timetable. And then we'll talk with Dan and we'll look at the calendar and see what the best strategy is for him. So, I think it's a bit early to think about that.
After the crash, the team obviously was in disarray. Half the guys were on the floor. I gather Fabian Wegman had just been off the back and he got back up and got back on. And was he the fifth counting man? Was it that kind of led to losing quite so much time? Because, you know, in such a short race, to lose 3:36, I suppose people would underestimate the huge, losing all that speed and then having to get back up to speed and gather
together.
Well,
basically, the time that the team registered was Fabian's time from when he was dropped, which was on the climb. After that, he was riding hard to get to the finish in the time limit, but not thinking that he was participating in the team's result anymore. So his time, the time of the team is his time from then, combined with when he hooked up with his teammates. Bear in mind that his teammates, the four of them who didn't crash, they were around the corner. So they didn't know what was happening. They didn't know when the fifth rider was arriving, if there was a fifth rider. It was like complete chaos, you know. So I think that we can consider ourselves extremely lucky to have only lost 3.5 minutes, because considering how it went, it should have been a lot worse. There was 8 riders left in the group at the time of the crash and 4 of them went down. So it couldn't have been... So to only lose 3.5 minutes was really a blessing. And that's not a joke.
In terms of the mood in the team, in a grand tour like this, only just started, there's no time to sort of wallow in it. You've got to pick yourselves up and go on. So is it about consolidating today and then trying to make something out of the race as it goes on? I gather you're not ruling Ryder out of having an impact.
Absolutely.
Later on.
No. No, I mean, I think that it's necessary and healthy that the riders have a chance to be disappointed, because they need to do that. It's up to us then to encourage them to stop it, draw a line in the sand, accept what happened and then just look forwards. That's partly my job, but I have to say the riders, because of the way cycling is, they're used to dealing with disappointment. So generally I think they're very good about that, and the mood that I saw at the dinner table last night, considering what happened, was about the best you could hope for. So I've got, absolute faith in them as a team, and I'm sure things will work well.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So that was Charlie Wegelius talking about Dan Martin. But what did we learn anything about any of the other favourites? These were not stages where we saw particularly any of the favourites, other than to notice. I certainly noticed that Nairo Quintana was always near the front, always surrounded by a lot of Movistar teammates, which you expect. Cadel Evans as well. That's the way he likes to ride these Grand Tours, isn't it? Really, really close to the front. A bit like Bradley Wiggins did in 2012 as well. But Quintana, it was, I thought, noticeable by being very prominent towards the front or with his team. But did we learn anything? Did we see anything?
I think Rodriguez is by far the worst place of the pre-race, well, what we would have thought would be the contenders. Lost a lot of time in the team time trial. There were question marks about his fitness coming into the race. He was always going to lose some time in that on that first day, but and it's not insurmountable. I think it's just over a minute.
Minute and a half.
But his form doesn't look particularly good, and his prospects in general don't look great.
Yeah, it's a lot of time bonus time bonuses to make up that time, and particularly Rigoberto Urán's Amiga Pharma Quickstep team second, Cadel Evans BMC were up there, and obviously Movistar did a great ride for Quintana. So other than Rodriguez and Katusha and obviously Dan Martin, everyone else kind of, you know, ticked the box. They got round. They didn't really concede too much, but the Dan Martin crash was a bit of a sickener for the Irish. One of their main protagonists crashed out so early. We heard this evening that he's had an operation on his broken collarbone, and he'd sent a text to Stephen Roach, who of course is his uncle, saying that he'll be back on the home trainer tomorrow, on Monday. So chances are, although Garmin Sharp were playing it much more cagely over the weekend, chances are that Daniel Martin will start the Tour de France, and I imagine we'll go there with the same kind of goal as last year, hunt for stage wins in the mountains. But it's a real shame, because in the Giro he could have raced quite aggressively for the high overall positions, because I think it would have suited him better in a way than the Tour. I think the mountains here, we haven't really seen him sort of stretch his legs in a Grand Tour to the extent that he could go and chase a high overall position. His highest finish, I think, 13th in the Vuelta. The climbs, I don't know, are the climbs in the Vuelta quite similar to the Giro? They can be. The weather is not going to be as hot. You know, he does suffer with allergies, breathing difficulties and stuff, particularly hot pollen-y type weather. So the Giro sometimes has some cold days. I just had this feeling that he was going to sort of ride high up into the top five, and obviously we won't get to see whether he was going to be capable of that.
No, I guess the Tour will perhaps offer us a chance to see what he can do again. I don't see any reason why, he came here with great form. I don't see any reason why he can't go to the Tour with great form as well. Now, we spoke to Matt White the morning after the team time trial. Orica GreenEdge, as we predicted, as many people expected, they won the team time trial pretty convincingly. They had a little bit of good fortune, I think, with the conditions. It started raining about halfway through their ride. It did also, I think, dry up for some of the later teams as well. But, they rode that very well, and obviously rewarded Sven Tuft, their Canadian sort of powerhouse, who has been a real important cog in team time trial squads of theirs over the last few years.
And it was his birthday.
And Sunday was Marcel Kittel's birthday, so he won the stage on his 26th birthday as well. But yeah, we spoke to Matt White, Director Sportif at Orica GreenEdge, and here was what he had to say about the team time trial.
Mission accomplished last night.
Yeah.
Very much the plan, and the plan to put Sven Tuft over the line first as well.
Yep. Well, what happened in the end is you can't... I said to the guys, Sven obviously is his responsibility to get over the line first. So obviously no one go over the top of him. But Sven got on the front row about 700 metres to go. And so he did a really big turn, but he probably should have changed going into that last corner. But it was a very, very long turn from Sven. So I'm glad we won it by 5 seconds and not... by under a second,
I mean, he said it was a birthday present, but also that it was sort of recognition of
It was nothing to do with his birthday.
No, I mean, it was recognition more of his.
Yeah, definitely.
He's a good team time trialist, isn't he?
Well, he's as good as our... He's our best. Mm. He's our best. And look, he's been a part of all of our victories in the team's time trial. And what comes around goes around. And that's how we do it in our team. It's the DNA of our team. Mm. And he deserves it.
Mm. Are you going to try and swap it around, Matt?
Well, today it will normally be a bunch sprint.
Yeah.
So whoever's across the finish line first from our team, we'll take it.
And
so
you kind of premeditated who?
Well, Michael Matthews is our sprinter.
Oh, yeah.
So he should have the jersey today.
Right.
That's our plan anyway.
Right.
So look, the only guy, Pataki, if he gets first or second on the stage, can roll us.
Yeah.
And BMC haven't got a sprinter.
Yeah.
And so all the other sprinters are a bit too far behind.
Matt, in the history of your team, you just have these amazing flurries of wins. It seems to go, you go a couple of months with not much
much happens and then they just all arrive at once. How do you explain that? Is it just...
I think it's how the season is. Where we plan our races, this happened to be good periods.
Yeah.
And look, certainly... You thrive off victories,
yeah,
for sure, but you know, this was always a period that we targeted.
Mm.
And we had a little bit of a quiet spell. We put a lot of energy into January, obviously, for Tour Down Under, and we were a little bit quiet in February and March, and then we're back kicking off in April again. So yeah. But this last 2 weeks has been incredible, really. You know, to win Liège,
mm,
and to win so many stages there at Romandy was a big surprise, with Michael Albertson. He was incredible, and he did that a lot on his own as well.
Yeah.
And then, you know, very promising for us to see Adam develop so quickly and win a great race in Tour of Turkey. And then this was always a plan 6 months out. As soon as we knew there was a team time trial here, we targeted this. So it's one thing targeting it, but another thing to pull it off. So
how do you execute that? I mean, you do have a great record in team time trials. You obviously got some guys with great team pursuit history in there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the secret to it? Is it planning? Is it, you know, and Tuft also said that last night it was particularly dangerous, of course, in the conditions. So yeah, how did you approach it?
Yeah, it's definitely a combination of things. It's not just one thing. Obviously, I put a lot of effort into the planning of guys, so the preparation, their race build-up. And I think that's changed, you know, from 10 or 15 years ago. Our guys are racing less. Yeah, out of all the World Tour teams, we race the least out of anyone.
Right.
We have a little bit more training camp and a lot more structure in our build-up. We've got a core group of team time trials, so that, and when you're taking those guys to a lot of the big events, that relaxes the rest of the group because they're the key guys. And we put a lot of preparation into it. We didn't overlook the course. I think some teams can get carried away with overlooking a course. And it was a dangerous course. When we checked the course out in the morning, the winds were very, very gusty. And you know, you make a small mistake on a time trial bike, and we saw with Garmin, it doesn't end pretty. And especially in a city circuit where there was a lot of manhole covers, we had wet roads for the last half of hours. Some teams had worse conditions, and the tail end teams had a lot better conditions. So it was a mixed bag for everyone. But I think, going back to what I was saying, it's a combination of things is why we're successful. And we haven't got Tony Martin. And when we lose to Amiga, most of the time it's because of Tony Martin, because he is by far and away the best time trawler in the world. And if you look at the footage of the World Championships last year, he did nearly the last 2 kilometres of that world title, and we lost by 0.8 of a second.
Yeah.
Now, he's an incredible athlete, and him on that team just makes a big, big difference. And we know we can beat any team in the world when Tony's not there, and when Tony's there, we've really got our hands full.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
So we're going to wrap up our time in Ireland. We're all heading home, maybe come back out to the Giro at some point. There's a possibility of that for a couple of us, I think. That'd be nice. It's been fun. But we'll wrap up. There's some other business as well. Daniel, you've been following up on a story that we've covered a little bit on the podcast, the troubled relationship between Filippo Pozzato and his team at Lampre Merida.
Yeah, I spoke to Lampre's South African manager, Brent Copeland, the evening of the team time trial. Just put it to him that the word on the street is that communications have completely broken down between Lampre and Pozzato. Pozzato was originally supposed to ride the Giro, and he seemed to have been dropped at the last minute and sort of almost ostracised. That is not quite the case. And he also touched on Damiano Cunego's prospects in this Giro d'Italia.
Last year looked fine with the team. He was meant to do Giro in his program. His condition just wasn't up to what we expected after the Classics. We preferred him to take a step back after the Classics and then start up again with Japan next week and either Delfinato or Switzerland and then to the Tour.
Right.
So seeing the stages, the first few stages of the Tour, actually pretty much suit him. So looked at his condition after the Classics, we just decided there was a better thing.
Because
obviously people that are saying that the relationship's not good, but
yeah,
it's just talk.
And how did you assess his performance in the Classics?
Well, we expected him to get at least the top 10 either in Flanders or Roubaix.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just... I mean, he got 17th in Roubaix, which is not bad if you look on paper, but the condition wasn't there to stay with the front guys. He was always in the back, coming back into the front.
And I understand you've given him quite a lot of freedom to, train on his own without... He doesn't train under Michele Bartoli, does he? He trains kind of on his own.
Yeah, he's 32 years old, that age... He kind of knows what to do. He knows how to get through his winter and how to turn up to the races in the best condition. So we gave him freedom of choice with that and freedom of choice with race selection as well. and that was up until the Giro. Seeing his condition wasn't good for the Giro, you know, just put him in just because someone's name's down. So we don't ever guarantee anyone their place. They ask if they can do that race schedule. We try to respect it as much as we can, but if their conditions are not up to it, we're obviously going to put the best riders in at the time.
And he'll be here next year? I know he's got a contract, but...
Yeah, I think so. We work well together. He's good for the classics. Get through the winter better.
What do you expect from Damiano in the Giro?
I personally think he's going to get a good GC ride. Just looking at the stages and looking at the percourse, it pretty much suits him up until Barola, and then obviously it's going to be a take on how the guy's doing the time trial. But he should do well in GC and go for a stage.
And at least it's obviously not the GC for him, but...
Working more towards stages.
With Ulissi, I mean... He has a similar profile to Damiano, and it's almost looked at times as though he could either go either way to GC or to, you know, more of a one-day rider. Does he see his career still developing in more of a one-day direction?
Ulissi?
Yeah.
I think that's... His intentions are always to work towards more of the classics and work towards more of a one-day rider. But I think he can do nicely in the short stage races as well, the one-week stage races. Obviously, this is a nice test for him to see how far he can go in GC, but we're not expecting him to ride for GC. Our plan, original plan was to ride for Horner. Obviously, that changed after the accident. So.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So that was Brent Copeland talking to Daniel. Now, so that's about it, I think.
Were we going to talk about our night out last night?
Oh, now you're bringing it up. Now you're bringing it up, eh? You didn't want to talk about this earlier. We had a bit of a blast in Belfast last night. That's kind of rhymes.
We were running with the night in Belfast. We were running with them, you know?
Running with the night.
Remember that one, 1983?
Oh, if I could ever forget. We were dancing on the ceiling in that nightclub.
We've had that before.
Oh, sorry.
Is the video clip of Daniel dancing going on Vine or YouTube? Or
I'm trying to work out. I took some video footage of Daniel dancing with our friend Ron Burgundy, a.k.a. Gregor Brown. Actually, it's the other way around. but They were pulling some moves, I think is the term, on the dance floor, and it was quite impressive. And I took some video, and I'll try and upload that and tweet it on the Cycling Podcast
@ cycling_podcast.
So look forward to seeing that. It was really quite entertaining. Anyway, what was your highlight, Daniel, of the Irish sojourn?
Definitely
Dublin.
Definitely that. Rich, the night out last night. Definitely those mean shapes I was pulling with Gregor.
Not just with Gregor, we should point out there were two females as well. Lionel, what was the highlight of your time in the Emerald Isle?
I think probably the bit when it didn't rain.
I can't remember that bit. When was that?
I was out at the finish of the first road stage briefly. Kind of, I was going to wait out there for the riders to come in, but then I had a piece to write, so I had to come back in again. But it was just soaking up the atmosphere out there and just seeing how many people were enjoying it. All the bars were full, the music was playing, and the sun was shining for that brief period of time. It was fantastic.
We were certainly soaking up the atmosphere. I thought you'd select one of the buffets personally. The buffets were very impressive.
I was trying to avoid selecting the buffet because I thought it would be a bit too predictable.
A cliche, isn't it?
Yeah, it's becoming a cliche. Although the buffet in the press buffet in Belfast was exceptional. It will take a lot for the tour to beat that this year, I think.
Are you listening, Leeds? Well, thank you very much for listening, Lionel. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thanks, Rich.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.